This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, October 19th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In the past few years, the economy has continued its steady recovery from the 2008 recession, with the stock market reaching unprecedented highs. Last week, the Dow Jones dropped sharply, losing 5% of its value in 2 days. President Trump blamed the Federal Reserve for the slump, calling its plans to raise interest rates out of control. In an interview with Shannon Bream on Fox News, he had this to say.
The problem, in my opinion, is Treasuries and the Fed. The Fed is going loco, and there's no reason for them to do it, and I'm not happy about it.
John Cassidy joins me to discuss the mysteries of Trumponomics and how voters are responding to an economy that seems extraordinarily strong, but also shows some signs that it may be unsustainable. Hey, John.
Hi, Dorothy.
I want to start by talking about the stock market's plunge. It's since bounced back, but was it an indication that the economy is beginning to overheat? And wasn't the Fed's move on interest rates meant to ensure that that doesn't happen?
Well, it's a very controversial question whether the economy is overheating. I think most economists would say at the moment there's very little sign of overheating. Overheating is usually associated with rising inflation, and there's very little sign of that so far. Inflation's basically around 2%, which is pretty much at the Fed's target. The Fed is worried that because unemployment is so low, it will eventually lead to higher inflation, and that's why they're taking sort of preemptive action to head off an inflationary spiral. Donald Trump, of course, has gone crazy about that. He thinks the Fed's gone crazy, and he's saying that they should basically hold their fire and that they're basically destroying this great economy, which he claims he's created. Of course, that's a big exaggeration, but the economy is in good shape, and Fed raising rates does represent a potential danger to it.
So Trump's critics are baffled by this economic success the country has been experiencing ever since he came into office. You know, we have low unemployment, business confidence is very high, stocks are high still, even after that plunge. And I remember Paul Krugman predicting in the Times just after the election that Trump would tank the economy. So let's be really daring here and give the president a little credit and tell us how you explain this.
Well, I mean, I think there's two things to note. Number one, the economy was in, you know, pretty good shape when Donald Trump took office. This recovery we're in, still in now, started way back in the middle of 2009. Trump took that over. Now, it was a sort of steady recovery. It was running at about the 2%, 2.5% growth a year. What's happened in the last 6 months or 8 months or so is the economic growth has stepped up from that rate of 2.25% to 3% or even 4% in the last couple of quarters. Now, there's a lot of debate about what caused that, but I think the main cause, most economists would say, is the big stimulus package, i.e. the tax cuts and the spending bill that Congress introduced at the start of this year, at a time when the economy was already doing pretty well, and that's produced this big spurt of growth, just as a stimulus in 2008-2009 produced. And that's bumped this the economy onto a higher growth path. Now, the big question, of course, is how long that's going to last. Stimulus spending usually only temporarily gives a boost to the economy. But certainly for the midterms, you know, this stimulus has worked for the Republicans. We've got 4% growth going into an election, which is usually very good for an incumbent party.
It's been a decade since the financial crisis, and I don't want to throw cold water on everybody's optimism here. But I was remembering that way back then, before the recession, you came on this podcast and warned that we were in a housing bubble. The consequences, you said at the time, could be dire. But everyone was enjoying it too much to do anything about it, including Wall Street. So are we in danger of making the same kind of mistake again?
Well, I think we are to some extent. When you get a recovery that's gone on this long, there are almost always some excesses associated with it. The obvious danger here, and we've seen this reflected in the last couple of weeks, is the stock market. The stock prices have basically tripled, more than that actually, since the low in the spring of 2009. You know, that's very unusual. I wouldn't say it's completely historically unprecedented, but it's virtually unprecedented to go that far that fast. So if anything goes wrong, you would expect a stock market correction. Now, that's what appeared to be starting to happen in the last week or so as the markets get worried about higher interest rates, and we've seen this sell-off on Wall Street. What we don't have this time round, which we had in the early aughties, is the big property bubble. And the banks seem to be more stable than they were. Thanks to the Obama administration's reforms and the Fed Reserve's own reforms after the last banking crisis, basically in the last cycle, banks had run down their capital enormously, borrowed enormous amounts of money, and they were basically, you know, toppling at the first sign of trouble. And that's why they had to be bailed out. So the financial system does seem stronger this time around. That's why most economists are not predicting a sort of return to 2008, 2009. They think if there is a recession over the next few years, it'll be more of a sort of old-fashioned recession, similar to the one we had in the early 90s or 2000, 2001, when the stock market goes down, unemployment goes up a bit, but not a sort of great recession or depression-style recession as we had last time around. But of course, you never know, and nobody can predict the future. But that's the conventional wisdom.
Our colleague Adam Davidson this week wrote a piece for NewYorker.com citing the IMF World Economic Outlook report, which warns about Trump's trade policy, that it could have major consequences for economic activity in 2019 and beyond. Could you talk a little bit about that? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely could. The trade policies so far have been very aggressive verbally, but they haven't impacted that many goods relative to the size of the economy. You know, the sort of little trade war we had with Canada, and he has imposed steel and aluminum tariffs, obviously, and they're scaling up on it in China. But the big danger is if they have a full-scale trade war with China. Basically, the Chinese have got a trade surplus with the U.S. of about $500 billion. And Trump is talking about imposing, you know, $500 billion worth of tariffs. Now, that could be a substantial shock to the economy. And even more importantly, it could be a huge shock to sort of world financial markets if they think there's going to be a full-scale global trade war, because the Chinese economy is already starting to falter. The Chinese announced this week that their rate of growth has fallen to 6.5%. Sounds great by American or Western standards, but it's actually the lowest rate of growth in the Chinese economy in the last 10 years or so. So there's worries about the Chinese economy going into recession, and it's now the second biggest economy in the world. So that would maybe give a shock to other economies too. We've known from the beginning of the administration that trade war is a sort of second-order danger, which, if it ramps up, could become a first-order danger. What's not really clear still at this point is whether Trump is bluffing. I mean, he talked very tough with the Mexico and Canada, and then at the last minute sort of reached an agreement. And now, on the face of it, there doesn't seem to be any grounds for a compromise agreement, because the Americans are demanding a lot of changes in the Chinese economy, which the Chinese definitely won't want to allow. So can a face-saving deal be produced, or will it just escalate into an all-out trade war? We should find that out, you know, by the end of the year anyway.
Trump's attack on the Fed presumably was driven partly by Republican worries about the midterm elections. And it's kind of interesting that because a strong economy is usually the greatest political asset a sitting president can hope for. You know, in 2010, Obama had the opposite, the deepening recession, which we were, I guess, just beginning to come out of, but it made the rise of the Tea Party possible. In terms of the economy, how does this election cycle compare to earlier ones?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting situation with the economy and the midterms, because if you just ignored who was in the president's office for the moment and just looked at the unemployment rate, the growth rate, stock market, etc., you would say these are basically ideal conditions for an incumbent party. We've got 4% economic growth. We've got the lowest unemployment rate since the 1960s. We've got the stock market at record levels. We've got wages finally rising, especially for at the lower end of the spectrum. We've got very low rates of unemployment for minorities. You know, the economy just looks stronger than it has for a long time, and that usually rebounds to the benefit of the party that's in power, even if they're not primarily responsible for it. But in this case, the Trump factor, at least until very recently, seemed to be overwhelming the economy, and that's why most polls still suggest that Republicans will do very badly, especially in the House. Now, things have started to tighten up in some polls recently, especially in the Senate. and the sort of conventional wisdom in political circles is that it's all a sort of reaction to the Kavanaugh hearings. That may be true. I mean, an alternative explanation, which I'm sort of partial to, is that Republicans just weren't paying that much attention to the midterms, because when your party's in power, you tend not to pay that much attention. It tends to be the people who are angry who get more interested early. Now, as the election's coming around only a couple of weeks ago, I think more Republican voters may be focusing on it. And then I think a lot of them say, well, the economy is doing pretty strongly and no reason not to go out and vote for Republicans again.
So I want to ask you, you were in New Jersey this week covering a key congressional race there, where the Republican candidate, Jay Weber, has pretty much embraced Trump's agenda without embracing his craziness. I want to hear about that and what kind of the mood you are picking up there and how Republicans were talking about some of these issues we've been discussing.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's very much along the lines of what we were just saying. Paul Ryan was there, too, and Jay Weber. Both of their speeches. This was at a in the New Jersey 11th district, which is a sort of pivotal race because it's an old Republican seat. The Democrats have got a very dynamic, attractive candidate, Mikey Sherrill, a former Navy helicopter pilot running. And it was widely seen as one of the seats that the Democrats needed to pick up and were likely to pick up. Now, the polls still show Sherrill ahead, but there was one poll last week showed it only a 4-point race. Republicans think they've got a chance, as and that was, I think, why Paul Ryan was there. Now, both of their speeches, the candidate Jay Weber and Ryan, focused largely on two issues. One, the economy. They both said this is a great economy. They recited all the economic statistics that I said. And then, secondly, they pivoted to attacking the Democrats. Paul Ryan said the Democrats are now unhinged. They're trying to drive us so far to the left that we won't recognize ourselves. They both attacked Nancy Pelosi. What was very notable, at least from my perspective, was that neither of them even mentioned Donald Trump during their speeches.
Mikey Sherrill, how did she frame the strong economy so that it would work well for the voter she hopes to win?
Mikey Sherrill's argument, which she made in television debate last week, is that, yes, the economy is doing great, seems to be doing great nationally, and that's good, but we're not seeing that here in New Jersey. Here in northern New Jersey, the cost of living keeps going up, rents, housing, healthcare, education, and you know, we need to concentrate on bread and butter issues. She's trying to make it about healthcare, education, infrastructure, sort of old-school Democratic issues. She doesn't actually bring up Trump very much either. She very much appears to be trying to localize the race.
You know, that interests me, too, because I've just been working on a piece that we're publishing in the magazine this week by Nick Lemon about Claire McCaskill, who is the incumbent senator in Missouri. And she's just a very strong moderate, always has been. And she, too, never mentions Trump. And she, too, focuses solely on local bread and butter issues. Her opponent, Josh Hawley, mentions Trump at every opportunity. So it's just interesting to see how in different parts of the country, candidates are grappling with the pros and cons of Trumpism.
I notice a lot of Democrats are now seizing on Mitch McConnell's remarks about Social Security and entitlement spending. The Democrats would love the election to be about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and about Republican threats to entitlements. You know, that's an issue they're sure they can win on.
To get back to the New Jersey race for a second, Mikey Sherrill is from liberal, very liberal, Montclair. And you mentioned in the piece you just wrote that Hillary Clinton was within a point of carrying that district in 2016. And this is a largely white, suburban, affluent area.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The main factor driving the Democratic resurgence there seems to be, you know, revulsion at Trump among moderate Republicans, especially women, lots of highly educated women there. The reason I think it's interesting is it's the sort of seat that the Democrats have got to win if they're going to win back the House. They need 23 seats, and there are more than a dozen of these sort of suburban seats in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and California alone. If they take all those, you know, they'll be well on their way to victory. One of the very interesting things, which I haven't mentioned yet, about these, especially in Jersey, and I think the same thing's happening in California and New York, the Republican tax bill. Even though Republicans are running on, you know, a strong economy, the tax bill is very unpopular in some of these districts because it eliminated state and local income tax deductions. So affluent families who pay a lot of state and local income taxes, because their federal deductions are going to be now limited to $10,000, they can end up paying thousands and thousands of dollars more in taxes as a result of a Republican tax bill. So it's a sort of paradox there that tax cuts in these areas don't appear to be working. In fact, they appear to be working against the Republicans.
Okay, thank you so much, John. We'll have you back in a couple of weeks after the election.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a regular contributor to NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This program is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
Hi, this is David Remnick. We've just launched a new project that I want to tell you about, the New Yorker's Midterms 2018 newsletter. Every week, our writers and editors will check in from the campaign trail to tell you exactly what's happening across the country and why it matters. The newsletter is only running through the November midterm elections, so sign up now at newyorker.com/midterms newsletter. That's newyorker.com/midterms newsletter.